When you're in the mood to cook, do you head to the internet for inspiration, or perhaps to that dog-eared, butter-stained old favourite, that classic cookbook on your bookshelf? It's probably a bit of both. I bet you haven't thrown those old favourites out, though. Recipe books, they're like old friends, and in spite of the internet, they are far from out of favour. I mean, your kitchen will be the proof of that. Dozens of them, I am sure. Now, these days, cookbooks, they fill large sections of the average bookshop, and among the glamorously photographed, celebrity-endorsed ones, they know who they are, there are many quieter volumes that have stood the test of time. Annie Hastwell took foodie Kate Jordan Moore for a walk around the recipe shelves of an Adelaide bookshop.
Hello, I'm Kate Jordan Moore, a cook, a foodie. I used to have a bookshop that focused on food and wine titles, and I still can't stay away from them.
Now, we are in a bookshop, a nice little independent bookshop in North Adelaide, and having a look at their fairly huge range of cookbooks. What takes your eye first up?
Oh, well, of course, it's all of the new titles that you've been following the authors. So a whole shelf of Otto Lengi, whom we had barely heard of about 2 years ago. I love the Annabelle Crab. It's always nice to see Matt Preston's smiley face out. And then there's all of these restaurants that, not that I haven't heard of, but, you know, I haven't barely been to them. So it's fascinating that you can now, you know, cook from your restaurants before you've even been to them, or, you know, go home and replicate.
So when you go back, trust would have been a big thing in the recipe world in the days when your grandmother handed you down recipes. And I noticed trust is still quite a big thing, really, even these days when there's so many cookbooks.
Oh, absolutely. If you think about it, all of those recipes were passed down. They were called receipt books. The word comes from to receive. So recipes were passed down. I mean, recipe books, cookbooks and household management books have been published for a long time. But you always trusted the recipes you were given, and they always had great names like Mrs. King's Pudding or, you know, Annie's Excellent Salad. And then what was interesting when recipes started being published in magazines in Australia, the Women's Day tended to take recipes from food producers. So, you know, the Golden Circle recipes and the flour recipes. Whereas the Women's Weekly set up the Leela Howard test kitchen, so you knew that all of those recipes were tested. And I think the food sections always said each recipe triple tested in the Leela Howard kitchen, and they really sold trust as an important thing, and that's part of the reason they have this great legacy of food knowledge and food recipes.
Well, let's have a look at a couple of those.
Yes,
over here, because I can see some old favorites on this shelf.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's one. I remember, showing my age, doing home ec at school, the Common Sense Cookery Book. And what I've loved about this book is it's extremely boring recipes. And I remember getting into trouble for suggesting that instead of making apple snow, boiling an apple to death, beating it up with egg white and food colouring, we just ate the apple. But they're really basic and they work. And what I've loved watching too is seeing the Country Women's Association reinvigorate in recent years, but also start publishing. So Liz Harfel wrote a great book, I think, called Blue Ribbon Cooking. And then now there's the Country Women's Association Country Classics. And again, these are great recipes that have been used and used and used, not just by the Country Women's Association. I mean, they didn't just gather these up for this book, but every country town. And in fact, you know, we've done it in the city as well. Every primary school, every thing, you know, produced an anthology of the local recipes. So you know that they've sort of all been passed down. And even though they might not always have the chatty writing of an Annabelle Crab explaining the provenance of a recipe, you know that they really, really work. And they're also really useful because often the country classic ones don't have the fancy ingredients. And there are just times we forget, those of us that live in the city, that you can't just turn around and drive 60 miles to get that sun-dried tomato or the rose water. And plain food can be delicious, particularly if you're being able to use things out of your own garden.
So looking at this immense range, which we've got indeed from Matt Preston, all the celebrity cooks, down to the Country Women's Association making an appearance again, what's a favourite for you?
Oh, on this shelf, well, the last cookbook I bought is in fact this one, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat by Samran Nosrat. This really excited me. It's so beautifully written, and she really gives you the power and knowledge that if you're already a pretty good cook, to trust your instincts, to understand, it's not the Harold McGee on cooking, it's not all about the science, but understanding the elements of good cooking and about flavour as well. I also love on this shelf Margaret Fulton. I mean, you can never go wrong with a Margaret Fulton. I know that there are sort of more modern bakers, probably with more glamorous styling. But again, every recipe was tested and she's cooking royalty.
So you trust her?
I absolutely trust her.
And what about the fact that she brought out an alphabetical cookbook? I think the first one ever.
She did. You're absolutely right. And that was really interesting because that, I think, was a very Australian, I don't know if it was an Australian innovation, but it felt like a very Australian thing because for a lot of us, you know, you'd sort of look at the big bag of apples or tomatoes or spinach that your aunt or neighbour had dropped on your doorstep and you needed to find it. And I think that's been the power of those books. Stephanie Alexander's Cook's Companion works really well on that. I mean, that really is the one book that everybody does need. Oh, on this shelf, this is Traditional Moroccan Cooking. Now, this one has the foreword by Claudia Roden. And that's one of the things that's been interesting is watching, as Australians travel, and we all know we all travel at the drop of a hat, is watching books come out about particular cuisines. So we're standing here in kind of a European section now. So, look, Greek, Italian. We've always had pretty good Italian cookbooks.
Barcelona cult recipes.
Cult recipes, not just the cooking of Barcelona. And, of course, there are fine Australian chefs like David Thompson, who's opened the world of Thai cuisine. But Moroccan cooking and, of course, Middle Eastern. I suspect Lebanese might have been the first kind of Middle Eastern food that Australians really ate, probably more urban. But I remember inheriting my mother's book of Middle Eastern food. And this was the first one that Claudia Roden published. And it is so fantastic. You can see I have
it. It's well worn.
Well, this is the copy out of my handbag. It's very well worn. It doesn't have the sticky fingerprints on it because I'm the person that finds a recipe, writes it onto the back of an envelope so that I don't get my cookbooks grotty. But meatballs with spinach and chickpeas is the recipe that's falling out because that was always a favourite one. But also to bird's tongues. This was one of the most beautiful recipes that you sort of go, oh my God, where will I ever buy bird's tongues? And realise it was one of those evocative Middle Eastern titles like The Iman Faints or The Empress's Thighs. And the bird's tongues are actually little pieces of pasta. So you didn't really have to start trapping pigeons in the park to make it. And it was her evocative writing that I think Australians and Australians that love food fell in love with because the recipes we were seeing would explain about the recipes or explain about the techniques, but Elizabeth David, Claudia Roden, they all told us about the history or the heritage of the recipe or where it came from. And so for Australians that weren't really travelling or perhaps Australians that had travelled and come back, that was the food that brought our travels back to life. Oh,
Annie Haspel and Kate Jordan-Moore looking at books in an Adelaide bookshop and finding Claudia Roden. Now, it's 50 years since Claudia Roden published a book of Middle Eastern food, 50 years ago. We weren't really on nodding terms with aubergines and tahini back then. We didn't know our couscous from our pomegranates, the food of the Middle East, of North Africa, the Mediterranean. Well, these days, it's as familiar as Yotamotolingi. In large part, we can thank Claudia Roden for that, a doyen of food writing, and she joins us now. Claudia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Can we start with that book, 1968, Middle Eastern Food? What was it about that food that prompted you to set it down, to write and research?
Yes, well, the food is the food that I liked in Egypt in my childhood. And I must say that much of it was actually Syrian because three of my grandparents had come from Aleppo, and that is the kind of food they had in the family. But we had a wider type of food because Egypt was then a cosmopolitan, very cosmopolitan country with many minorities. And also the Jewish community, which is the one I come from, was a mosaic of families that had come to Egypt from places like Morocco, Tunisia, even Iraq and Iran, but mainly from Syria, Turkey, and the old Ottoman world. And so I grew up with different kinds of foods, all from that kind of area, and also the Mediterranean, because Egypt, when the Suez Canal was built at the end or the middle of and end of 19th century, attracted people from all over because it became a great center of trade. But what attracted me or made me want to write was that, on the one hand, I was an art student in London, and the food at the time in the 50s was horrible. Anybody who was in London at that time, in Britain at that time, yes, will tell you how horrible it was. Of course, we can all say it now. We were embarrassed to say it before, but we can say it now because now it's the great capital of food of the world, or so we think. But what made me actually write was that after 1956, the Jews of Egypt had to leave Egypt in a hurry within a couple of weeks, and my parents arrived from Egypt, and also thousands of people left. We had been a big community, and gradually everyone left, but most left just at that time in 1956. And in London, I was inundated by all the people that I had left in Egypt were there as refugees. And so for a few years, that was my life, is being involved with people who had left and people who were wandering the world, where they were wondering where they could settle, and coming backwards and forwards. And during that time, I realized that one of the things that mattered, that they talked about a lot, was, do you remember that recipe you used to make? And give me the recipe.
So for that, for the art student, the young Claudia in the 60s in London, was that a curiosity or a nostalgia that then drove you to investigate that mosaic of food?
Well, it was nostalgia. It was nostalgia, missing really good food. I had been to Paris as a boarder, and I knew what Paris food and French food was like, and it was good. And the shock of having bad food was a real shock. But I did have a lot of friends at art school. I lived with two brothers. We had a flat. One was a medical student. One was still at school. And I was the cook at home. So I did cook very early on when I was a student. And we used to invite our friends from art school, and they would come, and they were just so happy to be eating at my house. I used to make all those kinds of things that are very fashionable now. They used to get it 50 years ago.
So was this a way, in a way, for you to investigate your own sense of past, to investigate that world of your parents, to flesh that out in food?
Yes, because on one side, on my father's side, the family was very Arab. They spoke Arabic at home, and it was a huge, huge extended family. So it was a happy part of my world. But I really wanted to be European, and my generation was very European. We went to an English school. We spoke French at home. We also spoke Italian at home with an Italian nanny. We spoke many languages. But our world was really, all our ideology, our ideas came from Europe. And that's what interested us. But when I was here, suddenly I had lost that other world completely, because we thought we would never be allowed to go back, because our passports were taken away, and or rather we were said we can leave only but not come back. And so it was a loss. But it became of great interest to me. And my interest grew with my study of food, because I went to the British Library to look for an Arab cookbook, because there had been no cookbooks in Egypt at all. Mm. That was one reason why I was prompted to, or I was encouraged to research the food. But at the British Library, the librarian told me to come back the next day, and he had a list of 13th century cookbooks, or not cookbooks, they were culinary manuals, and they were translations of the culinary manuals that had all been of the 13th century in Baghdad and in Damascus and even in Spain. One particular culinary manual by an Orientalist, French Orientalist, called Maxime Rodinson, who had been a soldier in Beirut and had, who was a sociologist, did his PhD on a cookery manual to discover what a society in the 13th century that cooked all those dishes, what could that society be? It showed him how to study what people's lives and who was it who wrote those recipes and for whom.
This is such an element in your work and your writing is seeing the history in food, the big sweeps of people and places in the things that they cook and that they eat.
Yes, and that is why, because also when I did start traveling, because I had three children really young, and when they all left home for university, I decided to travel the Mediterranean all alone, à l'aventure, just to discover it. And it gave me a mission, and it allowed me to ask people, to accost people whom I didn't know in a train or on a bench. But I also met a lot of people who were chefs and historians and so on. But when I asked for a recipe, I just wondered, what does that recipe represent? Hmm. I asked them who their parents were, what did they do, did they know about the history of their place? And I realized how, for instance, in Italy, first of all, the food was different in every region. And I realized that it was because every region had been a different country at one time, and with different influences. They had different occupiers. The French had been in Piemont, the Austrians in Lombardy and in Veneto, and the Spaniards had been in the south, the Arabs in Sicily. So I realized how that side of the food was. But also I realized that what their parents' lives were had made the food. And so I became interested of what Italy was like before the war. And before the war, it was a completely agricultural country with hardly any industry. And there was a system of what you call sharecropping. The Italians call it mezzadria, where the peasant farmers lived on estates as tenants. They cultivated the land, and they gave half the produce to the landlord. Mm. But it was the cooking was really the kind of cooking they had in those estates. They were fields, they're called podori, and the farming was archaic. And the peasants had everything growing, like wheat, maize, vegetables, rice, fruit. It was a kind of mixed vegetable. And they made their own wine, they made their own oil, they kept pigs, rabbits, and poultry, and some of them had calves, and they made their cheese, they cured their pork. So there's all this variety. And nowadays, it is industrial agriculture. Yes. Where it's all tomatoes or it's all something else, you see. And there isn't that kind of life, but their food lives on today.
If we can go back to 1968 and you have produced a book of Middle Eastern food, how was that received? What was the reaction?
Well, at the time, when I was working on it and I was telling people, because I worked on it for quite a long time, not thinking I was going to publish, but then even once I started thinking I'll make a book, I was talking about it a lot, but people weren't interested in food at all. To talk about food at the time was considered frivolous or silly. I mean, we didn't ever talk about food. If I went to a party and said, I'm researching food, everybody turned away.
Which makes, which makes what has happened in the 50 years since quite miraculous.
Yeah, it's been a revolution. And I feel that I could tell at certain point, I'm not sure which year, suddenly people started telling me what they ate when they went on holiday or when they what they cooked. And I just thought, what's all this? Because they would never, ever say what they ate. And if I asked them, what are you making for dinner? You know, it was total horror if I asked what they cooked, you know. But so, yes, it was a huge change.
Yeah. I mean, it is an extraordinary thing now to live in countries where, you know, the mosaic of food is so broad, where food comes from all over the world and is enjoyed and is documented, you know, that is such a shift.
Yes, I think people all over the world are open. But in some countries still, they like their own food, like Spain and Italy and France. But even France, it's now overrun by couscous and all that, and they also now like burgers are fashionable, you know, and ketchup. But it is especially Anglo-Saxon countries. It is more than any other country, in America in particular, are open to other foods. But I think it is also that food has become detached from where it's from.
Yes.
And it's become a thing to innovate, to invent, to be original. And the chefs are to be able to be recognized as a good chef. You are not an ethnic cook. You have to be an original cook who has their original, unique dishes. And also food writers, their editors tell them, do a kind of ratatouille, do your own take. If you don't do your own take, then you're not considered. And I'm told really by most of the chefs who are doing Middle Eastern and also food writers that they use my book as a primary source, or it's their Bible, they say.
Well, that is a tremendous compliment.
It's a compliment. But the trouble is, my book, the original book doesn't sell because it doesn't have photos. And everybody wants a photo for every dish, or they wouldn't cook the dish.
Claudia, it is an absolute treat to talk, and we thank you so much for your time.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Claudia Roden, food writer, author of many books, including the one we've been in large part discussing, the Book of Middle Eastern Food, 50 years old. And Claudia participated in the British Library's food season just of late. There are upcoming events. You can check their website out for details of those. We'll put a link up on the Blueprint page on the RN website. And this is Blueprint for Living. Here on RN.